This is Greater LA on KCRW. It's the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The place is Silver Lake at a bungalow in the hills. About a dozen people are sitting in front of a big projector screen, you know, the one that rolls up and down like a window shade. They're in their friend's living room. The anticipation is palpable. The host presses play, and about 3 minutes in, the room erupts with recognition. Jennifer Beals appears on the screen. It's a watch party, and this group of friends has been excited for weeks about the return of a TV phenom, the L Word. It came back this week after more than 10 years off the air. Now, if you've never heard of the L Word, you probably were not queer or thinking about your sexuality or gender presentation in the early 2000s. If you were, the show's return might feel like reuniting with some old friends.
The show was incredibly groundbreaking and revolutionary in so many ways. And the representation that it did provide, I thought was incredible at the time. There were things I saw on the show that I had never seen on television before that were really amazing.
The L Word is set in L.A., West Hollywood to be precise.
Girls in tight dresses who drag with mustaches.
It follows a group of lesbians as they navigate their friendships and careers and their love lives. It'd be hard to find an English-speaking lesbian of a certain age who hasn't watched at least some of it. This isn't the only watch party happening the night of the L Word's return to Showtime. All across Greater L.A., groups of queer people are gathering in living rooms and bars and bedrooms for this show. And on today's program here on KCRW, Cerise Castle and Carla Green report on the relaunch of television's most famous lesbians.
Now, the original L Word, and spoiler alert, the new version too, is basically a soap opera. It's dramatic, but it's also about the day-to-day life of a lesbian, or at least a glamorous, wealthy lesbian living in L.A. in the early aughties. It's about a group of friends, based around the idea that all lesbians in the city are connected.
Right. And, of course, it's television, so it's not real life. But then somehow it sometimes also feels very realistic. Like when I went to that Silver Lake watch party, there were moments where I felt like I was living inside of an episode of The L Word. It was this room full of queer women and they were all fashionable and drinking wine and beer. And just being there and reporting on it for KCRW, which is also in The L Word because one of the main characters hosts a show on KCRW at one point. It just all felt super meta, but also in this funny way, nice and familiar.
When this show came out, despite the soap opera feel to it, the impact on the queer people watching it could be profound. For the first time, they were recognizing themselves on screen.
So, there's this girl. And, like, when we were in, like, seventh grade, we'd, like, write, like, notes to each other, like, letters to each other, and we'd give them to each other during class period. We thought we were just friends. And so then, like, I was reading our letters to each other, and I was like, huh, maybe. Then I started watching The L Word.
This is Rachel Horvath. She's a 23-year-old woman I met at a recent event for The L Word's relaunch. She came out as gay last year.
So I grew up, like, believing that, like, I could, like, change my sexuality. And so I tried to do that until I was, like, 21. Finally, I was like, oh, okay, so I can do this.
The show didn't just inspire women to come out. Rhys Bernard started writing recaps of L Word episodes and eventually was inspired to build a space for the community.
I've always wanted to run my own magazine. Like, that's what I always wanted to do. But I wanted it to be, because there wasn't really anything out there for, there wasn't a lesbian queer website out there that covered, like, the full breadth of topics. We had politics, we had sex relationships, and where it was hot and sexy, and where people showed their faces.
So Rhys started that kind of website, Autostraddle. It's an online magazine and social network for lesbian, bisexual, and queer women and non-binary people. She loved the show. But frankly, she says, the original had some blind spots.
Number one was racial diversity. Almost everyone on the show was white. And a lot of the characters of color, the actors, were not the same ethnicity as their characters. The trans representation was really bad. I didn't like the way that they had Jenny's story proceed, because I think that she was dealing with a lot of really difficult things with, like, sexual trauma and
PTSD.
Past abuse and PTSD and all of this stuff, intergenerational trauma and with mental illness. And then they kind of, like, just turned it into this, like, oh, she's this crazy girl who everyone wants to murder.
So this is a pretty common critique of the L Word. Everyone kind of knows that the show was problematic in certain ways. That came up when I spoke to Devin Kirkpatrick, who was at that Silver Lake watch party.
The absence of butches, true absence of butches, is ridiculous given what a large portion of the lesbian community butches take up. And it feels, like, upsetting.
And then on top of that, there's the problem of showing women having sex with each other, but doing it in a way that it doesn't feel like it's performed explicitly for men. And arguably, this is something that they did not always pull off in the last version, but apparently it's also something they thought about in the relaunch. Sandra Valdez-Hansen was one of the cinematographers for the new version of The L Word.
We definitely made it a point to not shoot the intimate scenes in that male gaze. And it's hard to define what that is, but I think women understand what that is.
I think it's kind of like the whole pornography thing, you know, when you see it. So, you know, there are some flaws in the last version of The L Word that they're clearly trying to think more deeply about this time around. But then also, as Devin pointed out, The L Word is a soap opera, you know?
Right. And ideally, there should be lots of different shows talking about the lesbian experience, the queer experience. It shouldn't all fall on The L Word.
If you put all of the eggs in the basket of one show about white men, like, there's so many bad shows about white men. Let there be a medium, okay, soapy show about lesbians that doesn't necessarily need to be the end-all, be-all best show that ever was. But let there be more.
And if there are more shows like The L Word, that means that more queer people will see themselves represented in mainstream culture. And that can be especially powerful for people who don't identify as queer or don't yet. Meet Laura Ochoa.
I was super excited when it first came out.
And how old were you at the time?
Probably like 25 and not officially out yet. I mean, I was married and just had a baby, and then this show came out, and it just kind of really spoke to me in a really personal way.
So Laura started out watching The L Word, essentially in the closet. And then over the course of the 6 seasons of the show, her whole life actually totally changed.
So did you watch all of The L Word?
Oh, definitely watched all the seasons. And by the time it ended, we were doing big parties like this. Towards the end, the last seasons, we would all just get together at people's houses, and it became a big affair, and it was really fun, and I really looked forward to it.
Can you tell me a bit about what was the transformation that happened over the course of the L Word?
Well, I ended up meeting someone. I ended up meeting this woman who kind of introduced me to the community, and meeting like-minded people and beautiful gay people all over the city that I never knew were around. I felt very kind of alone and closeted, and I, you know, the way I was raised, I had some, you know, real thick streak of shame about it, and I was very secretive about it. And then towards the end, I remember by the end of the season, I was like out and very proud to be gay, and it was very much celebrated at the time.
And listening to Laura's story, it strikes me that I think it's actually a surprisingly common one.
Yeah, Rachel said the show helped her come out too.
Right, yeah, and I think that's actually part of why The L Word has stayed so relevant despite some of its flaws. Because on the surface, it's the show about glamorous, mostly well-off lesbians living this life of power and privilege in Los Angeles. So it's aspirational in the way that, you know, lots of shows about glamorous people are aspirational. But at its core, The L Word is actually just a show about this close-knit group of friends who are queer women.
Yeah, which feels like something that could be much easier to make a reality. And the thing that Laura's talking about, which I think is so common, is that just by virtue of being a show about lesbians and pretty much being the only show about lesbians, it brought people together to watch it, which then can help build that close-knit queer community that you see on the show.
Yeah, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, you watch The L Word, and then by some magic, The L Word becomes your life.
For KCRW, I'm Cerise Castle.
And I'm Carla Green.
Coming up, what happens when you take a DNA test to learn more about your family tree? You could wind up in a criminal investigation you may not want to be or may not even know that you're a part of. DNA and privacy. That's next on Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Thanks for being with us on Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. You have a truly unique version of it in your being. Deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. Sure is a mouthful. It can help you build your family tree, find out where your relatives come from, perhaps even find a parent you've been searching for, or a sibling or distant relative you may not have been searching for. And this holiday season, you may get a gift from a friend or family member in the form of a DNA kit. 23andMe, Ancestry, those are the big ones. But DNA is also used by forensic scientists and police investigators, the stuff of TV's Law and Order or maybe a crime thriller on the big screen. And what you may not know is that those real-life investigators are using or could be using that uploaded DNA in crime investigations, which of course is leading to a discussion about how all this important and unique information should be handled. Robert Messman is the Orange County Assistant District Attorney who oversees their Science and Technology Unit. Hi, Robert.
How are you?
I'm all right. Vera Edelman is a DNA expert for the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. Vera, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me on.
You bet. Vera, I'm going to start with you because one of the biggest high-profile cases that was solved with DNA was the capture of the Golden State Killer up in Sacramento. This happened last year. The suspect, a guy named Joseph James DeAngelo, he's a former police officer, had been at large for more than 35 years. When GED Match, this is one of those public genealogical databases, led authorities to him. Now, can you spell out, Vera, how the authorities used GED Match to identify DeAngelo?
My understanding is that there was DNA collected from the crime scene. That DNA was sequenced in a very information-rich and private way, creating a SNP profile, which is the kind of profile that a consumer might get from Ancestry.com or 23andMe. And that SNP profile was then uploaded to this database, GED Match, on which police searched for any relatives of the perpetrator of the crimes, and they ended up finding quite distant relatives from whom they then found a common ancestor and built out a family tree of hundreds of people, and then narrowed down that family tree to identify people who could possibly have committed the crimes based on location, gender, age. And so at many steps of the way, many people's deeply private information was revealed, from genetic information to public records that are actually linked through biology. So information about causes of death, about religion, about the numbers of births in a family, about potential births outside of wedlock, and other unexpected and private information.
Just to be clear, I want to say, because you mentioned 23andMe and Ancestry.com, it wasn't those databases where this information came from. This is from GED Match, right?
That's right. So GED Match, as far as I understand, is a database up to which people can upload profiles that they have generated using other services. GED Match itself does not create the profile.
23andMe and Ancestry say they don't offer that information, right? They're not a part of being used in criminal investigations, I believe. Is that correct, Robert Messman?
Yes, though Ancestry and 23andMe are not what I would term law enforcement friendly. Those databases are not publicly available to the public or to law enforcement. Genealogical websites that are publicly available include GEDmatch, FamilyTree DNA. Those are the main ones that law enforcement can use, because those are publicly available information That's available to anyone who signs up for the website, and including law enforcement. And there's even options on those websites where you can opt out or opt in to let law enforcement take a look at your information. One thing I would like to point out is we're not getting private DNA profile information here. What we're getting is information about names and contact information, and tells you how much DNA you have in common. We're not, law enforcement isn't seeing your private DNA profile. We're not knowing about your genetic information, your medical history, things like that.
What's the ACLU concern, though, about investigators using these public DNA databases? I mean, it seems like a good thing, right? If you can solve a cold case years after?
I certainly understand the interest in solving these crimes, and I understand the need to do that. But I think that this type of investigative practice raises a lot of privacy concerns. I think that DNA, as we've been discussing, is deeply sensitive, private, and also, interestingly, networked information that, as you mentioned at the start of this conversation, can reveal everything from one's identity to one's family relationships, ancestry, propensity for medical conditions. And I think that even though law enforcement may perceive what they receive only as identifying matches, in reality, some of these investigations lead to law enforcement knowing not only how much DNA individuals have in common, but where that commonality is. So let's say that's where someone has evidence of the BRCA gene. That match could actually expose that medical information.
Robert Messman, I mentioned earlier some of these DNA database companies have chosen to cooperate with law enforcement. Others have not. You said some are not law enforcement friendly. Do you even need their cooperation? Couldn't you just, I mean, if you're a law enforcement officer, just, you know, use a pseudonym and sign up for the DNA database?
Yeah, well, I don't want to get into specific investigative techniques, but yes, if something is available to the public, there's an argument that why should law enforcement be treated differently than any member of the public? If any member of the public can log on and get the information, shouldn't law enforcement, a detective, be able to log on and get that information? But the key here is, you know, I know the ACLU is interested in protecting privacy rights. So are we. We're not interested in violating people's privacy rights. We have strict policies and procedures in place to make sure this is done legally, ethically, and correctly. We have procedures in place to protect innocent third-party privacy rights. And we make the law enforcement agencies doing these investigations agree to these policies and procedures. And the Fourth Amendment, which protects against unreasonable searches and seizures, applies equally to any police investigation, including these. So there are protections in place, and the final arbiter is going to be the courts to make sure that it's done correctly, legally, and ethically.
Do you have ongoing cases that use genealogy in the process? Are you using those right now?
Yeah, we're in Orange County. We're prosecuting four cases, three murders and one rape. The crimes were solved using this innovative technique, and we have multiple current investigations. These cases aren't being used to solve the commercial burglary or the auto theft. This innovative tool is being used to solve the worst of the worst, the murderers, the rapists, the violent criminals, cases that have been unsolved for decades. One interesting fact is, there have been, you know, 70 cases around the country solved using this technique. In the majority of cases, these weren't people that were already in custody. These weren't people that were in prison or were deceased. These were people living in our community among us who had committed vicious rapes, murders, sexual assaults that normally, without this technology, would never have been solved.
The genealogical database that you use was Family Tree DNA, correct?
Well, we use multiple. We use Family Tree DNA is a law enforcement friendly website. GEDmatch is a genealogical website. It's not really. It's more of an aggregator. We've used that as well.
So Vera, what then do we make of the gift of DNA this holiday season? Do we just throw it in the fireplace?
I think that is entirely up to you. There are obviously benefits that individuals may want to get from using those kinds of DNA kits. There's a lot of information that they can learn about themselves. But our concerns really come up when the government starts to acquire that same information about us.
Robert Messman, Orange County Assistant District Attorney, and Vera Edelman, DNA expert for the ACLU. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. As long as there have been cars, there's been a gender debate among some folks about who are the better drivers, women or men. It is a question without an answer, but maybe you can frame it this way. Who is the safer driver? Is a man or a woman more likely to be at fault in a crash? Well, actually, there is real data for that, and the people over at USC's Crosstown News organization delved into some of those numbers. Crosstown is based over at the Annenberg School of Journalism, and Ethan Ward is chief number cruncher for this report, and he joins us right now. Hi, Ethan.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
I'm all right. This is so much more than just your misogynist Uncle Joe screaming about women not knowing how to drive, right?
Exactly, exactly.
You actually looked into the question of which gender causes more crashes. How did you do that? Where did you get this data?
So the LAPD makes this information public. It's for everyone. It's there for everyone to see. And we analyzed like nearly 500,000 collision reports between 2010 and 2018. And we found that men were responsible for 6 out of 10 accidents in the city of L.A.
So that's what you found out. 60% of crashes, 60% of those wrecks were caused by men.
Exactly. And this was each year. So this is a consistent thing that happens from year to year.
Really? It is consistent. It doesn't change much?
Nope. It's pretty much the same for men and women each year across the board. Yep.
What kind of wrecks are we talking about? Because, you know, there's one thing, especially in traffic circles, and I've been around doing I did traffic earlier in my career, and people get really sensitive about whether you say accidents or crashes. Right? Because an accident, yeah, somebody didn't really mean to do. A crash, maybe there's some negligence involved, things like that. So what kind of wrecks are we talking about?
Well, the LAPD hates the term accident as well because they feel that accidents can be prevented, you know, from people not texting and driving and stuff like that, whereas collisions are the more appropriate term. But yeah, this is just traffic accidents mostly that have happened in the city of L.A.
In the city of L.A., these are, yep, just cars on cars? Are we talking about pedestrians being hit, things like that?
So their collision reports actually include other vehicles. You can actually hit objects that are in the street, parked cars. These are also including cyclists as well. And that's also another huge issue here in the city as well, collision with pedestrians and cyclists.
Are there any theories about why it might be that men cause more wrecks than women?
Well, we don't know why they do, but I spoke to Lieutenant David Ferry of the LAPD, and he said that he was overconfident as a young driver, and I would probably agree with him. I remember growing up, and my dad would drive extremely slow on the freeway, which to me seemed like a hazard as well. And his thing would be like, they could just go around me. And I'm like, Dad, no, this is totally, you know, a reason that you can also cause a crash as well. So, yeah, I think that overconfidence in a lot of young drivers is, you know, probably to blame for that.
When we look at these numbers, the 60%, I suspect there are real world implications about that. How does that bear out, say, in the insurance realm and people being insured?
Well, up until last year, insurance companies were able to give people rates for their auto insurance based on their gender. They would use gender as a deciding factor. And they found that most of the time, women were paying more for insurance, and particularly women that were between the ages of 40 and 60.
Women were paying more.
Yes, women were paying more for insurance, even though they are not the cause of most of the collisions in the city of L.A. So thankfully, they banned that, and now they can't use gender as a deciding factor in deciding insurance rates, because I know a lot of guys would assume that they would pay more for insurance.
You know, I'm thinking of you as a student at USC, right? And, mm-hmm, and this is all real-world data that you're looking at each and every day. What have, yeah, you learned from all of this?
Well, I do a lot of crime data here and looking at the numbers for that. And I'm always very shocked and astonished at the things that are going on in this beautiful city that I don't think a lot of people pay attention to. So it's just definitely made me more hyper aware of my surroundings and, you know, just to be a better driver for sure. And, you know, trying to obey the rules of the road and making sure that I'm doing my part to not be a part of that 60% of drivers that are getting into collisions.
Ethan Ward, reporter over at Crosstown at USC, with some pretty interesting information today. Ethan, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Steve. I appreciate it.
That's going to do it for us today. Next on KCRW, the Bookworm reads you a story. We're at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Tara Atrion, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christine Comito, Amy Ta, and Christian Bordall make this show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great Thursday.